I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. Gary is also the founder of Clean Power Finance, an online marketplace for the solar energy sector, and Socioegramics, a financial services company that uses social media and behavioral economics to provide capital to consumers who don't otherwise have access to credit. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
I'd like to start with your upbringing. You grew up in Chicago. What did your parents do?
Both of my parents were teachers in the Chicago public school system. My dad was a driver's ed instructor. My mom taught accounting 37 years for my father.
What were you like as a kid?
Probably bratty. I was kind of a habitual problem child. While I was a good student, I ended up at the police a couple times. I remember one of my claims to fame is I broke all these windows and the police picked me up and made me go to the property owners and apologize. And me and a friend sat in the cell. And then another time we climbed the roof of our elementary school and broke a window and they took money from the Coke machine. I mean, I got kicked out of school for changing a program. And this was in the 70s and printing out some profanity. And that was that kind of intellectual problem child.
Did you have girlfriends growing up?
I had one girlfriend, but I wasn't very good at it, and maybe Match.com was my way of trying to, the idea of online dating was my way of kind of maybe more, getting more deal flow, as we call it today.
What were some odd jobs that you had as a kid?
I spent years actually working after school in a warehouse loading and unloading trucks. Mm. In fact, I worked for this guy who was a pretty good entrepreneur who did things like when Burger King had a misprint on glasses they were handing out. Like there was a misspelling. He would buy them all at 3 cents on a dollar and sell them in loco bodegas, you know. And I would be loading and unloading trucks for him for years and years and years. And when Pan Am went out of business, he bought all the little tchotchkes, like the little pins they gave kids and all the safety vests that were under the seat and found buyers for it. Mm-hmm. So that was like probably my first example of someone who could figure out how to make a profit in the situation.
You went to Northwestern. You graduated in 1985 and then made your way to Stanford Business School. Why do you think Stanford Business School accepted you?
Well, I talked about being an entrepreneur, and I had kind of an unconventional background because out of undergraduate, I decided I wanted to work in a nonprofit looking for fraud, mismanagement, and waste in the Department of Defense. And I think that was different from the normal investment bankers and consultants they had.
But you did work at Goldman Sachs one summer.
I did.
During Stanford Business School, and you rubbed one of the managing directors the wrong way, such that they offered to pay you to leave. What happened there?
They did. They offered to buy my summer out after about week four to leave them alone. I don't know if I rubbed one person wrong. I think I rubbed everyone wrong.
So did you kind of get a rise from challenging authority? Was this something that you liked to perpetuate, or this is just, you know, Gary Kremen?
Just the way I am, that sometimes me being there 4 weeks, I thought I knew as much as, you know, managing partners that have been there 20 years.
After graduating from Stanford Business School in 1989, you started two companies because you knew you were better off with your own gig. The first was a software company and then a computer securities company called Los Altos Technologies. And it was at Los Altos where the idea for an online dating company hatched. Can you explain how the idea for Match.com came to you?
So I had an epiphany one day. I noticed that we started getting purchase orders for our products. And I noticed that one day we got a purchase order from a woman. Mm-hmm. And that never happened in my history before, that actually getting email on the internet from some woman. And we're sitting around the office thinking, I wonder if, you know, what she's like and if there's any way we could learn more about her. And I realized that, oh, more women were going to get on the internet, because back then there were hardly any on the internet. And I realized, I wonder if I could create a database of all the women who are coming online and sell access to it and then marry number one.
Hmm.
Sort. Mary number one.
And Mary number one.
That's right.
This was the first woman, the woman who placed this order. Did you think you might marry her, or?
She could have been, and I was curious. So uh-huh. I wonder if I could convince her. I wonder if I could get her zip code. I had it. Actually, I had her zip code. I wonder if I could find the closest Kinko's, convince her to go scan her picture in, and then do a write-up on her. Hmm. So that was kind of some of my first ideas.
Because this certainly was top of mind was finding a mate.
Top of mind was finding a mate. And then just not me. I noticed there was a market in it on both sides. So at about the same time, I did my first good setup. I set up a friend with another friend, and they got married. I was like, wow, I wonder if they should have paid me for that whole process.
You at the time were also active in telephone dating services. You would pay $2.99 a minute for these 1-900 numbers. How did they work?
So there were newspapers out there, a lot of the alternative newspapers. All they were a little bit of content around these listings for 900 numbers, and you would read a little short description. You would call, paying $2.99 a minute to hear a description, a more detailed description, and then leave a message. And I realized a lot of people who own not only these newspapers, but other newspapers and classified, so were more richer than me. In fact, I didn't have too much money, but they did, and I wanted some of their money.
In 1993, you started a company called Electric Classifieds Incorporated with Match.com as your first service, and the idea was to take offline classifieds and put them online.
That's right. I realized that newspapers would be slow. I went to go talk to a couple of them, and I said, if I have all these domain names, I could create brands around each categories and put these newspapers out of business.
So your first subset of this electronic classifieds was Match.com, this online dating idea, and you bought the domain name for $2,500, which at the time was a pretty hefty number. Only 5% of Americans had internet access. How did you go about buying the domain name? From whom?
So, you know, first I used my credit card cash advance, as many entrepreneurs do. And I found the guy who was registered to, some person in Las Vegas who tried to do something in email and dating, and it never happened. And I think I came out of the blue like some sucker who was willing to write a check for something that had no value. I had this vision that I could do this whole thing through email, and you could say send picture of person number 27 and the picture would show up. And actually, that's what happened. That's how the early days were before the web.
Right, because this was an email dating service before the World Wide Web became more popular.
In fact, most people didn't even know the web was going to be. There were some alternate ideas, things called links and Archie, and no one knew where it was going to evolve. Mm. So we built a system that could talk to many different protocols, including faxes. People could fax in, and we'd use optical character recognition and realize what they were asking for. But eventually, the email service took off. We're growing at 3-4% a day.
How did the email service take off? Who were some of those early adopters?
Well, I realized something from talking to friends of mine, women friends, that I was able to kind of understand what some of their needs were in this area that was kind of a tough area, which is putting yourself out online where everyone could see what you were looking for, which was kind of a taboo area. I realized that privacy, security, and anonymity were very important. So I kind of came up with the idea of the anonymous handle that would have email and really focusing on respect in the process and the belief that one woman would bring 100 men, at least back then.
So give an example. So, Janet Smith wants to find a boyfriend, so she emails you, Gary, her picture.
Or maybe she just emails her biographical info, and we would do matching in our database to find out who would be looking for someone like Janet Smith around her, and we would send her the list in email.
So you would look at a database, just a list of guys who had signed up?
Now, it was done by an algorithm that we wrote and everything like that. But yeah, basically that was the idea. It's called matching. We matched.
Were you a participant in this?
No, actually, by that time, I actually had a girlfriend, which was hard to believe, but I did have one. So I was more of a looking at the process, but I wasn't touching the goods, so to speak.
I see.
Now, she did touch the goods and married someone from the service.
Now, at the time, you had a girlfriend, so you weren't using Match.com. Have you ever used Match.com?
I've never used it. Not that I'm against the idea or anything like that. It was just the circumstances.
You are married now.
I am.
And you have two children, two boys. How did you meet your wife?
I met my wife through a mutual friend who didn't know that we were each interested. So what I did when I realized I really need to get married is I made an offer. And if you set me up with the woman I marry, you get a trip to Hawaii for two.
Who did you make the offer to?
Everyone I knew.
What is her name and what does she do?
Her name's Petia, and she's a physician who specializes in integrative and holistic healthcare. I knew she was the one. And I think, you know, maybe by date four, she knew I was the one. You know, after we worked some those issues out, like the dog thing and stuff like that.
I remember when I first was learning about Match.com that there was a stigma attached to, oh, joining Match.com. And people were kind of embarrassed by it. That seems to have dissipated over the years now. How many marriages and how many successful matches have there been?
So probably successful matches in the millions, definitely the same number of marriages, but the stigma was the biggest obstacle to success. And worked pretty hard to make it a safe, secure, and friendly place and kind of change behaviors and beliefs that this is a positive, not a negative. It's definitely a feature, not a bug.
So what were some examples of things that you did to try to mitigate that stigma?
Absolute privacy, booting creepy people off quickly, throttling the amount of emails people could send to others, doing good matches, telling people if there was no match, there was just no match. Truthfulness, transparency.
The service, the email service, as well as the website eventually, started really growing 3-4% a day, really through word of mouth. What was one of those catalysts or turning points that really helped to escalate the popularity and growth of the service?
You know, one that I would say is I like to say we invented affiliate marketing. As far as I know, before we did it, no one came up with the idea of actively going out and marketing links to your website as opposed to marketing your web name and URL. And I was a big believer that let's go get the Women's Wire of the world to have a dating section and we'll be the back end for it. So I think the idea of affiliate marketing, something we all take for granted, was one of the ways we did very well. And two is we kept our service running. I know it's the craziest thing, but it's kind of an entrepreneurial lesson that you could have something great, but if it's not working all the time, it's kind of a suboptimum consumer experience.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. We'll hear more from Gary coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. In addition to Match.com, you owned a number of generic domain names, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, and then sex.com, which was later the subject of a lawsuit. Whom did you acquire these domain names from in the early 1990s?
There was one organization giving them away, and no one thought of going to ask. So I had an epiphany that generic words that are in the classified advertising would be very valuable one day. So there happened to be a little government contractor called Network Solutions in Herndon, Virginia, that somehow wrangled the exclusive right to give out these domain names, and they weren't getting paid per domain name because they were free. They were getting paid by, they would add up their costs and add 20% and charge the National Science Foundation for it. They were basically an office of four or five people who coordinated the handing out of IP addresses and domain names and associated internet artifacts. And they hit on, and I think about 95, that they should be charging $75 from that. That later was bought by VeriSign and became a huge public company just based on the revenue from that.
Did you pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I want to buy jobs.com?
So I sent in to an email address and I said, I wanted jobs.com, and I filled out a form. And I did that for all the domain names except the one that I did last, which was sex.com. And I realized, okay, I don't want this to get lost in email or someone on the other side to see what a good idea is. So I sent in a certified letter, and that was really good because there was a record of a certified letter.
So going back to Match.com, you raised about $4 million from angel investors and venture capital funds, and they invested in Electric Classifieds, which owned Match.com. And very early on, you and they did not see eye to eye. What are some examples of divergent points of view?
There was a couple different divergent points of view. Divergent point of view number one was, I believe that working with newspapers was doomed to fail. They were slow. They didn't get it in today's vernacular. Most of my board wanted to go work with newspapers, and that's kind of how they thought, well, let's go work with big companies. That's good. And I felt smaller entrepreneurial companies would grab the market, and I was actually right on that. Number two is, once when Match took off, I wanted to focus on that. I wanted to run with the winner. And they were like, well, let's go be the outsource partner for newspapers. And I just felt too slow. We'd never get there.
You owned a number of domain names at the time, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, sex.com. And they were fine with putting all these domain names under the auspices of Electric Classifieds, except for sex.com. Why did they not want sex.com in there?
Well, it was one in a many series of embarrassments that traditional stodgy venture capitalists who are backed by pension funds feel. The word sex were embarrassed. When I introduced gay dating, they almost had heart attacks right there and then, and they kind of told me not to do it, and I did it anyhow. When I said not everyone's for marriage, some people are looking for shorter-term relationships, I think I almost got fired that day.
Sex.com ended up being not just a scandalous affair, which we'll get to, but also your most lucrative domain name that you owned.
That's true. That's true. So that was another strategic mistake they made. I mean, I made a lot of my own mistakes, please. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm Mr. Mistake.
So what are some other mistakes that you made in the early days of Match.com?
So didn't understand the importance of who's on your board. Thinking all money is green was a big mistake. And I think I was pretty abrasive as a leader. I mean, I made a lot of leadership mistakes. I think I got the strategy right, for sure, but the tactics I wasn't as good at.
I heard a story that you fired a personal assistant or an administrative assistant because she wouldn't work 7 days a week. Is that true?
That's true, because everyone else was working 7 days a week, and it felt that there's always something to do, even if it's emptying the wastebasket, and I felt that that wasn't team spirit if you're going to take Sundays off. Because I was working Sundays, and I expected everyone else to work Sundays.
You were the CEO of Match.com for the first 2 years before you were ousted by the board.
That's right.
How did you feel when they voted you out?
You know, it hurt my feelings. I think that was one area where they were right. I was not mature enough to see that back then.
But at the time, you were just despondent and thought, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I have another good story. So when I raised money from the investors I did raise the money from, I had an offer from another set of investors, a more prestigious set of investors, like the best venture funds, Kleiner Perkins, IVP. And their condition on the investment was that I bring in a CEO. They had two conditions. One is bring in a CEO. And they would be let me part of the process. And two, they wanted to merge me with this other company, and I would have half the equity, and these other six people would have the other half of the equity. But no, they taught me in school, you want to be the leader, you want to be the CEO. So I said no. So I took the people who said you could be the CEO. Now that company went on, those six guys went on to change their name from Architects to Excite. And I would have had half of Excite and part Vested too. One of those, you know, couple $100 million mistakes that are common in my career.
And Excite went on to
be Excite worth at home and worth billions at the peak.
You left the company after 2 years, and the company was ultimately sold in 1997 for $7 million to Sendint, which is a consumer service company. And a year and a half later, the company was sold for $50 million to City Search Ticketmaster, which is owned by IAC, Barry Diller's Interactive Corporation. You made $50,000 from that sale.
I did.
How did that happen?
Well, it was part of the dispute over what direction the company wanted to do. But actually, the story worked out okay. I'll tell you the whole story. So what happened is I said, no, let's focus on this winter match. Let's have nothing to do with newspapers. We had big fights over it, and the board wanted to do the strategy of enabling newspapers to get online. And after they sold it, after my fervent objective, the company raised lots of money and it went out of business in 2001.
What company?
Match.com's parent, Electra Classifieds. They raised a lot more money trying to sell the newspapers, and it went out of business.
Got it.
So that was bad. But the good thing is I invented a bunch of things, and we got some patents. Like, I invented dynamic web pages, something every website uses today. So in 2004, a couple years later, I went and bought the debt in the last round, and I had a foreclosure sale to get that patent. And some other bidders came in, and I owned enough debt that on my $30,000 investment, I made a couple $1 million. So okay. That's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
So it was more than $50,000 in a very indirect manner.
Yeah, it was very indirect. But the real thing, $50K.
You had given up equity along the way,
ultimately? Yeah. And it's not that anyone else made any money. In fact, I think I was the only one who got any liquidity, even $50K. They all lost everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gary Kremen, the founder of Match.com, the world's largest online dating service. After the sale of Match.com, how were you doing?
Well, I was definitely bumming about the situation, but it was in such a good time in 1997 where a lot was going on. And I did have some unique knowledge. So I started working with a guy or two who had some ideas around collaborative filtering, something we see recommendation engines back then, and got that merged with a company called Firefly, and we eventually sold it to Microsoft.
For how much?
That was, I think, total $40 million. Mm-hmm. So that didn't suck.
Contemporaneous with these successful investments, you had a tumultuous period with a lawsuit over the ownership of sex.com. You had owned the domain name and contended that somebody had fraudulently taken it from you. Can you describe that briefly?
Sure. So I registered the name in 1994, first person who ever registered it. And I wasn't really focusing on it. I had all these other entrepreneurial things I was working on. And one day someone said, hey, didn't you own that name, sex.com? And I'm saying, yeah. And they go, no, this guy, Stephen Michael Cohen, has it's registered under his name. And I'm like, what? And I look it up, and it was true. It did. So I found out Mr. Cohen, who is a 5-time convicted felon, bankruptcy fraud, obstruction of justice, impersonating a judge, impersonating a lawyer, he stole the name from me. And he started, put up a website, and he was soon making about $1 million a month off the name.
Now, at the time, ownership of URLs or of domain names wasn't as secure as it is now, because it was really still the early days. So when you say he stole the name from you, how did that happen?
So initially, this is going to sound dumb, but I didn't realize how valuable the name was. I didn't know anything about the sex industry. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. So I had a little kind of investment firm, and there was a lawyer just fresh out of law school named Sherry Falco, and I gave her $2,500 to go investigate what happened, and that's how the whole thing started. And she found out about this, and then she got a call from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying, well, the reason Mr. Cohen now has the name, even whether he took it or not, is he had a trademark on the name. So we let it drop. We found out later that he was impersonating the USPTO, one of many things that he's impersonated in the case. So after
he had called her directly?
Oh, yeah, and said he was from the Patent and Trademark Office. And she believed it, and I believed it, too. And it hit us later that you can't have trademarks on generic words. So eventually we filed this lawsuit.
And so you found yourself associated with the porn industry pretty publicly. What was your view of that?
Well, what can you do? I needed the money. While at the time I was having legal bills of $100,000 or $200,000 a month, I needed financial support for what I was doing. I didn't have liquidity from my investments yet.
And how much of your mind space or of your headspace was this lawsuit taking up while you were trying to focus on your investing?
Well, eventually it took up 110% of my time. I learned the law. I read every brief, every pleading, which there was over 1,700. It's the longest case, I believe, in the Northern District.
When you finally got sex.com back, what did you do with the site until you sold it?
So I didn't want to run an adult site, and I came up with the idea of turning it into a search engine because there was so much traffic, and then selling those search results to other search engines. And eventually I sold it.
Isn't that effectively running an adult site or perpetuating the porn industry?
Okay, I didn't kill the porn industry. I had to eat. I had to pay my $5.6 million of legal bills I had.
And your judgment was $65 million in damages, but you didn't get the $65 million, so...
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I've still been collecting. So all I got out of it was a lot of heartache. I did get a house eventually. I did take the bad guy's house, and I lived in it for a couple of years.
Really? How did it make you feel to be, like, in the bedroom of the bad guy? Why would you do that? Of all houses you could choose.
It was kind of a nice house. It was in Rancho Santa Fe, which is this nice area of... Yes, that's true. A nice area of San Diego. And I just, I don't know, you know, there was something to it because he tormented me so much. Yeah, there was a little redemption. I mean, some of it was functional, some might be dysfunctional. I sold it a couple of years ago.
Your income stream has been kind of erratic, it seems. You haven't had a steady flow of income.
I have not, and banks are always saying something to me about that.
Was there a time after you started Match.com where you were worried about, you know, your financial state?
No, because I was always living pretty low. So I was living in the Western Edition section of San Francisco in a $300 share, and I was eating burritos for years and years and years. So I kept my burn rate super, super low. And the landlord didn't like the fact that I wasn't making any money. And I don't know. So I'm actually sometimes a nice person. So I met this like semi-homeless guy and I let him sleep on my couch for a couple days. And he took some pictures of the guy leaving and he tried to evict me.
You have since moved away from the dating and the adult industry to a cleaner energy, the cleaner energy sector. How have you made that shift? Was it a mindful shift or an accidental one?
Well, I've always been interested in not always the energy part, but sustainable living and systems that would work forever and that were light touch on the environment, kind of the leaving no trace. I've always had an interest in that area. So just after I sold sex.com, I invested in a friend's company, and she had women-friendly solar panels was her idea. So I gave her money to kind of produce these, well, what I thought they were going to be mustard or taupe-colored solar panels, racking systems, because her belief was that women were some of the big decision makers in the purchase of solar, and they're ugly. And if they made them, and it made sense to me. So what happened was not as many people were buying the mustard or taupe colored panels as she thought. And I asked her why, and I go, aren't you selling to all these rich people? She said they don't have the money up front for it. And I had this epiphany of the idea of why not create a financing company to finance solar panels. And if the financing product would be correctly designed, the consumers would pay less than the cost of energy from their utility bill, and they'd want to sign up for that. And that actually worked out. I wrote some software that helped the installer do their job, and then they all ran this software, and then we introduced the financing product eventually. I mean, there was a lot of twists and turns.
Now, Kleiner Perkins is one of the investors in this company. Who are the other venture folks?
Claremont Creek Ventures, Google, Clean Pacific Ventures, and a lot of individual angels, including myself.
Were you at all worried that your reputation would be tainted in this new chapter of yours as you were raising capital, for instance?
I was a little bit. The good news is investors want to make money, and, you know, any challenges in reputation stop when you have a good idea. They want to make money. They don't care about the past as much, I found. As an investor, I'm kind of like that, too.
This time around, you brought in a CEO. You knew you didn't want to be the CEO. Is that just a matter of growing up? I mean, you were 30. You were in your late 20s, early 30s when you were launching Match.com and trying to run it. Is there anything else that is attributable to this change?
Well, I've heard, Jessica, if someone hits you on the head enough times, you remember like, oh, I don't want to be hit on the head. So I remembered, I'm not that good of a manager of people. Why don't I find someone who is a good manager of people?
Now, your other company, Sociogramics, which you launched in 2010, is a financial service company that facilitates lending to the underbanked. And you're using social media tools to help determine credit worthiness. What's an example of a social media tool that you might use to influence responsible borrowing?
Let me give you a really clear example. Today, when someone applies for a loan, if they can't find them at the credit bureau, they're usually just denied unilaterally. But there's a lot of people who aren't in the credit bureau or don't have an extensive credit file. We believe that using social media, finding their profiles out there and other traces of them and other ways of verifying they're real people with real jobs, that's good enough reasons to lend to them.
Your idea for Sociogramics came from a personal place. What is that story briefly?
So I had a great relationship with a bank in Marin, California. And I knew the officers there. They knew my story. They knew my situation. And they could tailor products and services to me. The bank got taken over by a large bank, Union Bank. And it was like night and day difference. Instead of talking to the CEO when I had a need or my representative, it was a call center. And the relationship soured quickly. And it got me thinking why the personal touch is not only important from the consumers, it's important from the bank side. So I got thinking, is there a way we could use software to bring back community lending? One of our ideas is start bringing back essays and having people write about what they're going to do with the money and what's there been history of repayment as a. And I think there's a lot of efficacy to that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm honored to be here, Jesse.
My guest has been Gary Kremen. Coming up, we'll meet Dan Yates, co-founder of Opower, a software company focused on energy efficiency. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of Opower, a software company focused on energy efficiency. Opower works with utilities to monitor how much energy a consumer uses and gives households and businesses incentives to lower their energy consumption. The idea is that through the use of behavioral science techniques such as peer pressure or peer proof, people will feel more compelled to act more responsibly, at least to keep up with their neighbors. Dan started Opower in 2007 with his Harvard College classmate Alex Lasky. The company is based in Arlington, Virginia. Prior to starting Opower, Dan launched EduSoft, a software company focused on public school assessments. EduSoft was sold for approximately $40 million to Houghton Mifflin in 2004. Dan is an avid hula hooper. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I heard you like giggle a little bit after hula hooper. Is that true?
I guess I'm a good hula hooper more than an avid hula hooper. It's become a running joke in the company after the first company picnic we had where there was a hula hoop contest that I nearly won but did not win.
Other than hula hooping at your company, can you describe what else you do at Opower? How does Opower work?
Well, is there anything else to do other than hula hoop?
You tell me.
Yeah, Opower is a software company. We work with utilities to help them transform the way they deliver information to their consumers. People just don't really know enough about their energy use, and they're not motivated in the way they could be if they had the right information. And if we could just give them the right info, we could change energy behavior. And so what we do is we use behavioral science techniques, and in doing so, we've shown that we really can substantially reduce consumption consistently and persistently. And on average, we drive about a 2% savings, which for an individual, not much.
What is that, like $40 a year or so?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for a utility, I mean, it's $160 million over our customer base per year.
And why are utilities caring to collaborate with you? Why do they have the incentive to decrease energy use? I know it has something to do with state-level compliance.
That's right.
But can you explain that further?
Legislatures have decided, hey, there's a better way. Let's roll, instead of, you know, to meet demand, let's pass a standard that asks our utilities to run programs to help people save energy. And so then the utility puts forward a portfolio of programs, things like light bulb subsidies and Opower. And then what happens is they put a small tax on the bill. And the only programs they run are ones that actually save you more money than they cost. So the tax is always less than your savings. So the key thing is that utilities, with that tax, they get to recover any of the revenue they would have lost. So they're still made whole. So that way everybody, you know, everybody wins.
We're talking about incentives based on behavioral science techniques. What incentives are most powerful for people to reduce their consumption?
The most well-known of the techniques that we employ is the neighbor comparison. It's how we started. So the first product we brought to market was actually a mailed paper report, and we chose the mail because utilities don't have enough customer email addresses. It shows people how their energy use compares to their neighbors and then gives them targeted recommendations on how to save. But the peer proof is a very powerful tool, but it's one of many. Mm-hmm. So as an example, commitment is another very powerful behavioral science technique. Typically, customers who set a goal to save energy save over 8% a year. A third example is just rapid feedback.
You see a lot of this dynamic in other areas such as exercise, right? You give people instant feedback. They're setting their goals. There's the social pressure.
Absolutely.
Where else do you see this?
Well, I think there's a whole trend now of the measured self. All of these different wristwatches that track your heartbeat and change, you know, how many steps you've taken, they're not doing anything to you other than giving you feedback. But what we measure is what we modify. So the behavioral science is more of a tool to grab the customer and engage them about themselves.
How are you using science behavioral techniques in your personal life, for example? Like, with you have a baby, you're married. Do you see yourself like constantly applying these techniques in other ways personally?
I've been accused anxiously in business cases situations of being an expert negotiator because people fear that I have some mastery of the behavioral science sphere that I must admit I don't think I have. Mm. But yeah, you can't help but think about these techniques.
In addition to the behavioral science component of the company, you also have a pretty robust data analytics feature. Can you describe that some more?
We can help people understand their usage in very easy, timely, and important to act on ways. As a simple example, we do a predictive high bill forecast. So we've all had that experience where you get that bill in the mail in the middle of winter, and it's $500 or $300, and it blows you away. Now you get a call from us, like a fraud alert. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're 12 days into the month. You look like you're on track for a $300 bill. And what a relief, especially for a low-income customer.
They receive phone calls?
That's right, we do.
Are you the voice for these calls? Because you have that voice, or you're impersonating that voice quite well.
You have received a high bill. No, it's not me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, and an energy efficiency company that partners with utility companies to reduce energy consumption. The utility companies pay O-Power for its software and receives payments from the government as an incentive to encourage energy reduction. Now, when you first thought of founding this company, did you have this behavioral science in mind, or is it something that you arrived at after coming up with the idea?
Actually, the behavioral science component was one of the original pieces.
And you have a chief scientist. His name is Robert Cialdini. He's a social psychologist. How integral was he in the founding of the company?
Yeah, so the way we got started was we had a simple idea that there were a billion utility bills going out a year to Americans, and there was this huge missed opportunity to educate people about their energy use. But that was, and we knew there was energy efficiency funding out there, but it wasn't enough to start a business. And then we got lucky, and this is where the serendipity came in. We were introduced to the research of Robert Cialdini, who had just the year prior concluded a study with the Hewlett Foundation in San Francisco, or Palo Alto, rather, that showed conclusively that if you gave people information about their energy use relative to the average of similar sized homes in the area, that they would reduce their consumption.
How were you introduced to him? By whom?
I was talking about, there's a lot of people, and I was waving my utility bill around at breakfast with this woman, Rhea Sue, who's the Hewlett Foundation, and her eyes went wide, and she said, "You won't believe this. We literally just got a research report on this very fact, you know, 2 weeks ago." And she scanned and sent me the studies. And then we reached out to Bob, and it's been, you know, that's the beginning of the story.
Could you explain the study that he did with the fans?
The study was to try and convince residential homeowners to make a simple, low-cost efficiency move of turning off their air conditioner and switching to a fan in the evening. And they did a door hanger campaign. And they put a door hanger on each door with four different messages. The first message simply said, it was a monetary message. You can save $50 every month if you do this. Second message was about the environment. You can help keep the skies clean for California if you do this. Third message was about preserving resources for the future and being a good citizen. And then they measured those first three against a control group, which received no message. And they saw no impact in consumption, as if they hadn't come. And this is, again, an expensive way to go about marketing. So they had a fourth group that got a message that simply said, in a recent survey of your neighbors, three-quarters of them say they turn off their AC and switch to a fan in the evening. Join your neighbors. With no justification for what the personal benefit was, the economic benefit, the environmental benefit, none of that. Just do what the rest of the folks are doing. And that group saw a 6% reduction in consumption.
Why were you and Alex focused on doing something in the energy arena? You had started a company in education, for example.
So I started an educational software company called EduSoft, and we sold the company, and I had the opportunity to take some time off. And I talked my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, into taking a year-long trip with me. We bought a Toyota 4Runner, we shipped it up to Alaska, and we drove the full Pan American Highway from tip to tip.
So from the Arctic Sea to Patagonia?
That's right.
How did you meet Toby?
We met at a wedding in Birmingham, Alabama.
So here you are on a road trip in Latin America, and what connective tissue is there to O-Power?
So we took this trip. Among other things, we were listening to books on iPod, and we had downloaded Jared Diamond's Collapse, which is really the story of human populations throughout time that have had ecological collapse, ranging from the Mayans to the inhabitants of Easter Island, and you know how through leadership collapse can be averted, and without it, you can have true catastrophic, you know, ecological degradation. And as we were driving the drive, it felt like I was watching the movie in real time accompanying this book.
What are examples of that?
When we were driving through Guatemala, we were driving across this large plain with cows and bucolic scene. And then we arrived at this outcropping of rock. And on top of this rock, probably a couple acres worth, was the densest rainforest you could think of. And it hit both of us. This huge plain we were driving through had historically been a rainforest. But when you see those things and you see how stark it is and you realize how much we have changed the earth, that's when it hits you.
Toby Whitman, you're now wife. You were still boyfriend and girlfriend on your Latin American trip. What is something surprising that she learned about you on that trip or not on that trip?
She thought I was going to propose when we got to the southern tip, and she hadn't talked to me about that expectation, and so I didn't do that, and that was a shocker. So I made it up to her. What I explained was that I felt odd proposing to her after being a year away from friends and family and feeling disconnected from them, which was just how I felt. I felt like in many ways proposing was more of a public thing than a private thing because I knew I wanted to marry her. Mm-hmm. So to make it up, I went and videoed all of her friends and our families telling them that I was going to propose to her and asking them what they thought. And then I proposed by showing her this video of basically everyone else knowing before she knew, which was a lot of fun.
So here you are. You and Alex are starting O-Power. You both don't have a background in the energy industry. What were the first things that you did?
As we were just starting this, we were talking to some folks in Texas who told us that we just had to get down there and get involved with what was going on on the legislative side. And there was a bill being introduced around energy efficiency. And we flew out with not even yet incorporated, but with a blow-up, you know, mock-up of our energy report, 2-foot by 3-foot foam core blow-up, marched around with no company, with no brand name, with not even business cards. We managed to meet with all of the key legislators, and we got legislation written into this bill that authorized the utilities to use this public efficiency funding for home energy reports.
Mm.
Now, never mind, there were a few dots that we didn't dot and T's we didn't cross, and we weren't able to use that funding for years to come. But for us, it was this amazing realization that if we could move the needle that far with so little, that there was a real appetite for this.
Yeah, it was incredibly self-actualizing.
Yes. So then we said, okay, let's do this. And that's when we got serious. We raised some money, we incorporated the company, and we went out to, and we hired some people and we went out to go sell utilities.
Do you have a story or an anecdote about your early meetings with some of these utilities?
Well, our first utility that we sold was the City of Sacramento SMUD, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. Allie Crawford, who was a program manager, had funding for a carbon calculator, which was tools to enter in the different parts of your energy use throughout your life and calculate your total carbon footprint. And we showed her what we were doing, and she just was fascinated by it and thought, if you can do my calculator and this, we can work together. And so we went back and in a 10-day period worked nights and weekends and built a carbon calculator.
Were there other utilities or other recollections of meetings with utilities who were not as amenable to what you were doing?
No, I mean, you can't succeed without hearing no 100 times.
Right. So what are examples of some of those?
Most of those are customers of ours now, so I don't have any great examples I want to share.
We talk about getting funding in the early days, and NEA in D.C. was one of your earliest investors, and there's a story of Harry Weller, I think he's a partner at NEA, hearing what you were doing, and he said, utilities give you data and they're paying you? How do we invest?
Yeah, so Harry had a very clear vision, which took me a long time to fully appreciate, that the real power in our business was that we were being put in a position with all of the utilities' energy data to be able to help them on a whole host of consumer-facing issues they had. And that the fact that they were entrusting us with their data put us in a phenomenally strategic place in the landscape. And then that they were paying us for that, as opposed to us begging them for it, was even more astonishing.
I want to talk about your upbringing, your early life. You grew up in San Diego. Your dad was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And your mom was a Hebrew school teacher.
That's right.
What did your dad do in the Air Force?
He was a pilot. He was an instructor pilot with a T-33 jet, and then turboprop, rather. And then he flew C-130s for 10 years, which are those huge cargo planes.
Was he ever in action?
He was. He was in Vietnam. He flew air support in Zaire, back when we thought that Mobutu was a good guy to back up, which is, you know, not his proudest day, but he was a good airman. After my dad left the military, he went into defense contracting. He worked for a couple different firms. We ended up moving to San Diego, where he worked at General Dynamics.
We always like to put a bow around like how our childhood influenced what we're doing now. But like what are certain elements of your youth that feature prominently for you?
Yeah, I think for me, if I can draw a line back from O-Power to my youth, it's conservation and computer science. I took a class in 11th grade in AP Pascal and loved it.
AP Pascal being a programming language.
Exactly right. It felt like you were bringing the computer to life. To be clear, I was not a hacker who spent their nights and weekends writing code all the time. But I said this is what I want to do. It's where I want to go and what I want to study in college, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me is, I grew up in a family where we would reuse plastic bags, and we always turned out the lights, and we barely ran the heat, and these kinds of things. It established deeply ingrained in me an aesthetic that we shouldn't be wasteful. And my mom grew up in Israel in the 50s. They had nothing, you know, and my dad grew up very poor. So I grew up with parents who had their upbringing in a totally different time and era where they were extremely conservative with things.
After college, you worked at a music startup called Echo Networks.
That's right.
From there, you then started EduSoft, which is this company focused on the public school assessments area. And Jay Kimmelman was your co-founder at EduSoft, and you had known him from Harvard as well.
That's right.
What is he doing now?
Jay Kimmelman has started a network of private, very, very low-cost schools in Kenya. He has, I believe, over 50,000 students now in his schools. And the schools cost less than the public schools. And they have perfect teacher attendance, and they have significantly higher student scores and he's scaling this now across Africa.
And incidentally, you were raising money for EduSoft in 2000. So even though the story ends well, you had kind of a tumultuous beginning, at least raising money, is my assumption.
It was brutal.
I heard a story that you, when potential investors would visit, you would fill your desks in the office to make it seem like you were busier than you were. Is that
right.
True?
So we had...
Whose idea was that?
It was Jay's, of course. Jay was a magician as a kid and a vacuum cleaner salesman, and so he had all the great tricks. It was actually the first time Houghton Mifflin came to our offices. We wanted to appear bigger, and we told our friends we would buy them coffee and lunch if they would come and work out of desks and our office from 10 a.m. to noon.
Mm.
And we put phones on the desk and made it all look like we had 12 people at the company when there was only four of us. The problem was... 2 months later, the same guy came back, and we were like, what are we going to do? We got to get the same friends in.
So don't be fooled if you enter the office of O-Power. Some might be paid actors.
I can affirm we have no paid actors.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.